This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson. Hello, Paul.
Well, hello, Susan, and I know our listeners are going to have real fun today because we had fun on our road trip to Gilbert.
Our two road trips, but that's a story we'll tell later in the program. First, we'll have a phenology report from Pat Schlarbaum about red-tailed hawks and another update from Cal Halliburton about one of the candidates for Secretary of State.
Well, sounds like we're going to learn a lot before we get to the new cafe in Gilbert.
Yes, and we're ending with something that's a way a lot of people relax, a detective novel with a new mystery writer from here in Central Iowa, Raleigh Link.
Well, now it's time to get started with Pat.
Phenology is writing down nature's happenings when they occur. The last bluebird of autumn or the first junco of winter are noted in a journal for future reference. Think of phenology as a living diary of dates in nature. Today's phenology is about red-tailed hawks. So driving through Peterson's Pits this weekend, I was greeted with a pair of hawks. They were casting a wary eye my way, like stone statuettes only inches apart. They shared the same branch. It seemed misplaced to see such a solitary icon perching side by side. 'Tis the courtship season for red-tailed hawks. This is the only time of year they perch side by side. Soon the pair will be refurbishing their nest from last year. It's a mass of sticks creating a platform. They construct high in the tallest tree in the grove, and their time side by side will return to solitary perching as a single hawk for the rest of the nesting season. Red-tailed hawks are a medium-sized bird of prey known as a raptor. Raptors include hawks, owls, and eagles. All raptors have keen eyesight for spotting their prey. They have talons for grasping their prey. They have a sharp beak for ripping their prey as they eat meat. These hawks are often seen perched near roadsides or soaring over fields. They are by far the most common hawk in Iowa. Yet there are a wide variation of colors for red-tailed hawks. They run the spectrum of nearly white to black as coal. They can appear very light-colored as criders or very dark-colored or melanistic. Yet one similarity is usually exhibited in all color phases. Their throat, bib, and belly will be light-colored. And most importantly, across their belly, there will be dark flecking or mottling, creating a belly band. The belly band is the best identifying thing to note for red-tailed hawk identification. They have long broad wing and a short wide tail with a reddish-brown color. Juveniles or young of the year lack the red tail. Until their second year, their tails are banded brown. As is the case of hawks, owls, and eagles, the females are about 25% larger than the male. Females do the majority of incubating eggs, so they are larger. Red-tailed hawks build nests in tall trees, often the tallest tree in a cluster, or on cliff ledges. Towers, nest platforms, and buildings are also used for nesting. The nest is a collection of sticks lined with bark and other material about 3 feet across. Beginning in late February, both adults help incubate the 2 to 3 eggs for 28 to 32 days. The female stays on the nest and broods the young for the first 30 to 35 days after they hatch. The male brings food to the female to feed the young. And after 42 to 46 days, the young leave the nest or fledge, but they can't fly for another 2 to 3 weeks. The red-tailed hawk is one of the most widely distributed hawks in the Americas. It breeds from central Alaska and Yukon and the Northwest Territories east to southern Quebec and the Maritime Provinces of Canada and south of Florida to the West Indies and Central America. Red-tailed hawks occupies a wide range of habitats and altitude, including deserts, grasslands, forests, agricultural fields, and urban areas. For many years, a famous red-tailed pale male shared its wildness with Central Park visitors in New York City. So red-tailed hawks eat small mammals, including rodents and rabbits. They also eat birds, reptiles, fish, and insects, and they scavenge upon roadkill wildlife like our deer. Red-tailed hawks will steal prey from other raptors. So the red-tailed hawks are well adapted for soaring and spending long periods riding thermals, searching for prey. It is frequently seen sitting on utility poles, where it watches for rodents in the grass along the roadsides. Their call is a pierce-scraping scree, like a The raspy cry of the red-tailed hawk is used in movies to represent any eagle or any hawk anywhere in the world. That is the sound you're going to hear about 90, 95, 99% of the time. And that's our phenology for red-tailed hawks, seen perching side by side this time of year. This is Pat Schlarbaum with KHOY Community Radio, 89.1 Story City, Ames.
In case you just tuned in, this is KHOI Community Radio, and we just heard from Pat Schlarbaum and a red-tailed hawk about what the red-tailed hawks are up to. I picked that report because a few days ago, a red-tailed hawk kept flying by the window of my third-story apartment before he perched on the telephone pole. I've never seen a hawk from that angle. It was really fun. I only saw one at a time, though, so I wasn't lucky enough to see the pair that Pat was talking about.
Well, it's time now to meet one of the candidates running for the primary for Secretary of State, an office we really don't hear that much about.
Susan. Well, I know I never did, but this year there was a big change in voter registration initiated by the Republican Secretary of State, Paul Pate, that has led to challenges from two Democrats. Deidre DeJure, who we'll hear from today, and Jim Maurer from Boone, whose interview will air Friday. I think this will be an interesting race to follow, and I thank Cal Halliburton for his insightful interviews.
It's our pleasure today to be talking with Ms. Deidre DeJure. Ms. DeJure is running in the primary election to be held June 5th for the Democratic Party nomination as a candidate for the Iowa Office of Secretary of State. I should note that in Iowa, the Secretary of State is the top elections administrator and also oversees all business registrations. Ms. DeJure is a Des Moines businesswoman and owner of Kaleo Enterprises, a marketing firm that helps small businesses with branding and aids businesses and nonprofits in marketing to hard-to-reach populations. DeJure is a Mississippi native who came to Iowa to attend Drake University for a bachelor's degree in broadcast journalism and politics. In addition to her business, she's also a consultant for the United Way of Central Iowa on programs to encourage financial literacy for low-income individuals and better business practices for small companies and nonprofits. DeJure was an organizer and vote director for the Obama for America campaign in 2012. She volunteers with several organizations, including the Des Moines I Have a Dream Foundation, Back to School Iowa, and the Financial Literacy Network of the Department of Education. DeJure and her husband, Marvin, reside in Des Moines with their two dogs, Macy and Maurice. Deidre, tell our listeners something about yourself that they'll not find on your website or with a search engine.
That's a great opener. One thing that people will not find that I'm finding more and more people are seeming to think it's interesting is that my husband and I own beef cattle in Oklahoma. And that's where my husband's family farm is. And we travel there occasionally to go in and check on them. But we've got a great looking herd of some limousine crossbred with Angus, and it's delicious.
As you talk with people across the state, what are their most frequent concerns that are affected by the Secretary of State's office?
This office in the past has kind of been under the radar. But in this year, I'm compelled to run because of the impact that this office has on people's votes. and, you know, talking about this office being the commissioner over elections and campaigns, having the ultimate say in deciding how people vote, when they vote, and where they vote, I think is so integral in times like this. You know, we should be in a space where we're encouraging people to participate in our elections. And it's in that office that we can make that happen. And I am compelled to make sure that that happens, to truly be a champion for people's voices. You know, when we're looking at our small municipal elections like city council and school board, where we see about 5 to 10% of folks throughout our state participating, we can do better than that. We can do better than that. And those are nonpartisan races. So you're not seeing the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, Libertarian Party playing a very integral role in that. And so when it comes down to figuring out where we can find an individual that will ensure that people are participating in that elections, it's hard to find right now. But I know if I'm in that office, then it won't be hard to find, because I'll be ensuring that people are connected with that office and are well assured that their vote matters and it's counted.
Let's assume that you get elected. What specific actions will you take to implement this general idea?
Mm-hmm. The biggest thing is increasing our turnout in our elections. And from a basic, simple vantage point from where I come from voter engagement, and I come from the small business component as it relates to marketing. The concept when I deal with my customers, or my clients rather, from a small business vantage point, is figuring out ways to meet their clients where they're at, to better sell their products and their services, whatever they're offering. That is what the essence of true marketing is. We need to do that as it relates to voting. We need to ensure that we're connecting with our voter base throughout the state of Iowa, whether they're registered or they're eligible to register. We have to connect with those individuals, and we have to connect with them at each and every election. I think that voting is our most fundamental right, and as a state, we have to own engaging people to participate in the voter process. The other component is, you talked about earlier, anybody wanting to do business in our state has to go through that office, whether you're an Apple or you're a mom and pop shop on Main Street or you're a farm. You have to connect with that office first. And I think right now that that office is well positioned to connect our business owners to the resources that are going to help them grow. You know, for the business owners out there, sometimes, you know, we feel like we're a little lost in the process. And when we think about all of the departments that exist on a statewide level, the Secretary of State's office is the office that people have to go to. Some people don't file their taxes. Some people don't have to work with Iowa Workforce Development or Iowa Economic Development, but they have to go through that office first. And so rather than just be a rubber stamp, stamping people's articles of incorporation and literally saying, go about your business, that office can connect our business owners to USDA opportunities, to Small Business Administration education and loan opportunities, for our minority business owners and our women business owners, the targeted small businesses opportunities that exist. And these are investments that our state is committed to, but our business owners don't always know about. And so I'd rather not take for granted that just because someone is starting a business or has a business, that they know all the ins and outs of doing business in our state. But that office, the Secretary of State's office, can ensure that they're at least connected, they're at least educated. And if they choose to use the information, that's up to them. But we're at least doing our part to service our business owners.
It sounds like you're going to be pretty aggressive at moving forward on some of those issues. Let's take them one at a time. Let's take the voting issue, because I think that's probably the thing that's most in everyone's mind if they're thinking about the Secretary mm-hmm. of State's office. It's really important to make those connections with people. What do you do to make them?
You want to know my secrets?
Yeah, I do. I think our listeners would like to know what
your secrets are, how you're going to
make that happen.
Of course. I'll give you a few of them. So the biggest thing, well, I shouldn't say the biggest things. I'll give you three top line items. One is automatic voter registration. So when a person goes to the DOT to get an ID or to get a driver's license, right now you can opt in to voting. I would rather us have a system where you opt out, because that truly gives us the existing data on who is eligible to vote in our state, matched up with some other data as well as it relates to people's naturalization status and things along those lines. I think that is one step. The second step that I think would be very, very important as it relates to voters is maximizing the opportunities that exist for outreach. We have a number of organizations throughout our state, both partisan and nonpartisan, who have a vested interest in getting people out to vote. Let's bring those organizations together alongside our county auditors and really start to develop some strategies that will better help those organizations do their job in connecting with voters and also ensure that it's in line with all the legalities that the auditors have to comply with. I think that is very important. Our auditors operate in six regions throughout our state. And what we've learned along the way as we've been traveling, we've gone to almost 40 counties and a little over 130 events. And what we've learned is that every region or every county in our state does not operate the same. Every county does not have all the same resources. But if we could buckle these counties up into these six regions and develop strategic plans around voter outreach, I think we'll step ahead of the game. The other thing is we can't forget about our youth. We can't forget about our young people. You know, we are one of the states who has many colleges and many universities, especially from the private vantage point. We can't neglect getting our students involved. I first voted as a college student. I first learned about the importance of voting and what exercising that right meant as a college student. And so if parents are entrusting the state of Iowa to educate their students, I think that we have to make sure that there is an easy pathway for our college students to exercise their right to vote as well. And so there will be massive approaches to educating and getting our college administrators on board with voter registration statewide, and ensuring that each and every Iowa student who wants to vote in our state has the opportunity to do so. The other undercurrent is those students that aren't yet eligible to vote, so our high school students, getting them involved in the elections process sooner rather than later, giving them opportunities to work at the polls and things along those lines, I think is going to work wonders. Because as we all know, when peers do certain things, the peers get wind of that, and then they become even more engaged. The overlying concept and the theme of my campaign and what I would like to do in that office is, despite anything that's going on nationally, that we're going to own our voter contact in our state and getting people registered. And we're going to do that in an inviting way. And for people who have been turned off to politics, who are disengaged and not really interested in being involved, we're going to give those folks a reason to vote again. This office is a partisan office, but it has nonpartisan implications. We're talking about the value of the vote, not creating barriers, being inviting. And we're also talking about encouraging small business ownership and supporting that as well. So, yeah, those are the big three things that I would like to do in that office. And all of that is tied with marketing and outreach and making a concerted effort to doing that. And it doesn't take extra money. It just takes care. Someone who is making that a priority for our state.
Deidre, is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners before we depart?
There are at least 125,000 registered voters in our state who don't have an ID or a driver's license. Secretary of State sent them special voter ID cards back in December. But needless to say, it's important for people to understand that if they don't have an ID, if they don't have a driver's license, but they are pre-registered to vote, then they can still cast a regular ballot that day. Pre-registered voting is going to be the biggest thing that any voter can do this year to avoid any conflict or any question. Our registration deadline for our state is May 25th. So for folks who aren't sure if they're pre-registered to vote, what that means is that if you're pre-registered to vote, you're registered to vote today in the address that you live in the precinct that you live in. You can go to the Secretary of State's website to check out whether or not you are pre-registered to vote if you're already registered. It's not a good day when we are changing the process of people's most fundamental right, and people are owed a little bit more, a lot more than what's happening, and none of us can afford to stand on the sideline this go round as it relates to the vote. I am tremendously optimistic about all the great things that we can do in that office, but the first part of making those changes is changing the individual who's our Secretary of State. And I'm ready for the job. I'm ready to stand in the gap between, you know, voters and whatever barriers that they may have, to just be a bridge for those things.
Well, Deidre, thank you very much for joining us today. We appreciate your spending some time with us and sharing your thoughts about the Secretary of State's office.
I was really happy to be here.
It's been our pleasure today to be talking with Ms. Deidre DeGier, who's running in the primary election for the office of Secretary of State of Iowa. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Paul Wearson and I are your hosts for today, and we're about to take you with us on another road trip. Those of you who've been listening to Local Talk since we went on the air in 2012 know that we like to visit the small towns of our area, our 7-county listening area, because they are so distinct from each other in ways that we like to explore.
Well, you know, Susan, I still live on the farm in Story City where I grew up. Although my career was in Des Moines, I retired there. And my Norwegian ancestors are among those who settled in the area, so I have relatives scattered throughout Story County. Well, now, these days, as a retired guy, I teach an 8-week program for RSVP for 5th graders called Speak Up, and this is where each student writes a 3-minute speech on a subject of their choice. There's a timekeeper, an MC, and all that sort of thing. We do that at Gilbert, at Colonesco, Nevada, and also some schools in Ames, and so we have a lot of fun working with 5th graders in all these small towns, and Gilbert is one of them.
Well, I'm surprised we haven't been there before. Although I've lived in Ames most of my adult life, I never paid much attention to the surrounding area until KHOI went on the air, and I was assigned to go out to record Paul's interviews with local mayors. The result was that I was amazed at the personalities of the towns, the character, the pride of their citizens, and the determination of scores of volunteers to build on their past to make them good places to live and visit in the future. The story I'd heard was that small towns are dying, but the ones we've visited seem to be thriving. We've traveled, usually in Paul's 1996 Buick, as far west as Jefferson, north to Webster City, to Madrid, Ogden, Boone, Pilot Mound, Moingona, and Jewell. In Story County, we've kept track of the festivals, businesses, and schools in Colo, Collins, and the Ballard Creek towns. On Wednesday, we don't usually spend much time on Ames, since our beat is our 7-county listening area. Maybe that explains why we've overlooked our nearest neighbor, Gilbert.
Well, we started to pay attention to Gilbert a couple of weeks ago when the Ames Children's Choirs held their choral festival in the beautiful Gilbert High School auditorium. And at that time, we saw an article in the Ames Tribune about the Vault, a new restaurant in the old bank in Gilbert. And we decided to travel there to the Vault to begin our tour. Here we are in Gilbert, Iowa, at a place called the Vault. It's a restaurant, and it's actually on the location of classic old bank here on Gilbert's Main Street. And it's going through a transition into a restaurant after having been a variety of businesses over time. And we're going to meet today one of the spark plugs who make this happen along with her husband. I want to introduce Amanda Doring. Tell us about how you found out about this old brick building in Gilbert.
I'm from Ames, went to Iowa State for hotel restaurant management. And my husband and I met in Ames, and we actually used to work together in a restaurant. And he did the culinary program at DMAC. Mm-hmm. We actually moved to Chicago. We were there for 7 years, working in restaurants. But I always had my dream of opening up my own place. So we left a couple years ago, and I was just looking around the area because my parents still live here in Ames, and I knew they'd be a great source of free labor. And so I actually happened upon this listing in Craigslist. And my dad knew the building because he used to work for Coca-Cola, and he used to sell things back when it was a tea room, when Joe had it. Yeah. He's like, well, I know that building. So we came up and looked at it. And pretty much every person that came to see the place told me, don't buy this old building. But I fell in love with it, and here we are.
And you could visualize to some degree what you wanted to do here, too.
I did. It was kind of hard to see the space because when I first looked at it, it was serving as a place to sell antiques and stationery, so it was full of stuff. But it had existing sinks and a refrigerator and a stove, so I figured I could do something with it.
Now, this building, it was built in 1900, I believe, and it was a bank for quite a while, right?
Yes, it was a bank until I think 92 or 93. And what I've been told by all the locals is Ole, the original teller, it closed when she retired. And I think a lot of people's concerns when I bought it was that I would take out the teller line, take out the teller window, change a bunch of stuff. So when they saw that we redid all of the original hardwood floors, kept the teller window intact, and that's why I tried to keep it as neutral as possible to make it feel like it was back in 1900.
And so there are vaults right here in the building, hence the name of your restaurant, The Vault, right?
Yes, there are two vaults.
Two vaults. And it has an interesting history. I believe there was a bank robbery here. Tell us about that.
Well, I was not around in 1915 when the bank robbery happened, but I do have some old pictures of it. It looks like they used dynamite or something to blow through the original vault door.
The original 1900 vault is still intact.
Yes, that one's intact, and it's the addition that was built in 1914, that vault is the one that got robbed.
So the addition really is in the rear of the building.
Yes.
And in the old pictures, you can see where it's a different tone of brick. So you can see that there's been an addition built on.
And you can also tell from the mortar that was used, because
really?
We had to have a tuck pointer come in and do a lot of outside work because there was a lot of water damage. And you can actually see the brick, where one is like lime and stone, I believe, and then the other one is concrete. He said around like 1905, like that's when they started using concrete as opposed to the lime and stone.
So this bank robbery, they got away with the money, did they? Did they get caught? Do you know any details?
I don't know any details. All I know is they did not get caught. I don't know how much they took, but I know that they did not get caught.
But it was only a year after the addition and
yes.
the new vault was put in. So
yes.
Do you have any suspicions there?
Well, I do have my suspicions, but...
Might have been an inside job.
Yeah, that could have been an inside job.
But now the vault is a restaurant, appropriately named because of the presence of two vaults
here in the facility, and you have redecorated and made some good choices about woodwork and all that sort of thing. How do you plan to use this space? What kind of a restaurant is this going to be? What's your clientele going to be?
So we are trying to keep it very casual cafe setting. So you actually order at the old teller window, and then you can sit wherever you want. In the nicer months, we do have a patio that you can enjoy your sandwich outside. We're open Thursday and Friday, 7 a.m. to 3, and then Saturday, Sunday, we're open 9 to 3.
Okay, so your business is going to be sort of a lunch place.
Yes.
Where you can have lunch.
So we change our menu every week.
Yeah.
Because we only have 4 items to choose from every week. So Thursday through Saturday, it's one set menu. And then on Sunday, we do a special brunch. So we just have more breakfast items available on Sunday.
Well, I think it's a beautiful location. And there's a eating area out front here, right inside the door. And then you have the teller windows, and then there's a walkway back to another rear room where there's another eating area and a restroom facility. So the patrons actually have a choice of which area to eat in and what window they want to look out of, right?
This is true. And we also have a little kid station, a little kid's kitchen in the back room that they can play and keep themselves
entertained.
Is that
right? Yeah. They can
watch. It's called the mini vault.
Okay, and they can look at the vault and everything.
Yes. Well, this is our brunch menu.
Oh, that's brunch.
So this is from Sunday. We have strawberries and cream French toast. Sorry, breakfast tacos. And then we did have a corned beef hash on the menu because of St. Patrick's Day. We try to keep the menu themed with the week. So last week for St. Patrick's Day, we had shepherd's pie, a Reuben, and baked mac and cheese. For Mardi Gras, we had chicken gumbo. So we try to keep it seasonally and kind of themed throughout the week.
So you have emerald cream soda. Was that a special for St. Pat's Day?
That was a special, yes. And Irish cream latte.
That's where your flexibility comes in, to do specialty items and be right up to date with what's going on holiday-wise. And your husband brings something to this equation too, doesn't he?
Yes. Although he does work his full-time job, he comes after hours or on his off days, and he makes all the soups, sauces, and dressings. Yeah, he graduated from the culinary program at DMAC, and he is the sous chef down at Green Hills Retirement Community.
And so in time, you will both be laboring full-time, and this is going to be your baby. And right now, you are the lead in this project because of his obligations. And how's the traffic here? Now, Gilbert has such a small, abbreviated main street these days, but you have great housing developments sprawling all over, so there's no really worry about clientele, is there?
Well, it can be hard sometimes, but we do get the teachers who come in Thursdays and Fridays, and they can order carry out. Our neighbor next door, JB Knacker, they get a great following, and she's open Fridays and Saturdays. So we do get a lot of those people coming in, either stopping for a drink or getting a sandwich.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio.
I'm your host, Paul Wearson, with co-host Susan Franson. We're still on the road to Gilbert, and after learning about the vault, we went over to the high school to check out the auditorium, and that seats over 600 folks. Principal Christopher Stroud showed us around and discussed the upcoming bond issue. 5-year-old high school already needs an addition. Gilbert has a population of less than 1,100, half of whom are under 18. But it has a school population that's approaching 1,500. Well, why? Well, the southern boundary of the school district is Tapahala Road in Ames, just by Ada Hayden Park. So a lot of North Ames is in the Gilbert School District area. There are also rural housing developments north and west of Gilbert.
As we left the high school, we agreed that we needed to come back to Gilbert to talk with someone who'd lived here for a while. By checking at the Gilbert Historical Society, we found the ideal person, Terry Harriman Gallahan.
Here we are at the Gilbert Historical Museum in Gilbert, Iowa, and we're with Terry Harriman Gallahan, who is officiating here at the museum, and she's on the city council, she's on the library board,
and totally involved here at Gilbert. So, Terry, good to have you with us. Tell us about this building. What's the date on this building?
I would guess this building to be maybe around 1960. My parents owned a grocery store in a building that's no longer here. They sold the grocery store in 1960. The people that bought the grocery store felt that it was too big, and so they brought this building in, I believe, in the 60s, I'm guessing. It's been many things. It's been a post office. It's been a grocery store. It's been an office, and now it's a museum.
And then you have the library, too. You're on the library board, yeah. And you manage the library. What are the
no,
hours?
No, I do not. We are a branch of the Bertha Bartlett in Story City Library.
That's right. I knew that, and I'm on the foundation board.
Oh, okay.
That
sure,
library.
Sure.
So I know how that was formulated. And that's a nice facility. And you share the books and have this relationship.
We do share the books, or they share the books with us. Any books that are donated here, then we get to keep those. Should we ever grow big enough that we want to have our own library, then we would get to keep all the ones that were donated.
So now the library is right next door, and you can hop between both buildings, can't you? You're very active in both organizations. Right. Now the library, how long has that building been occupied by the library? Is that recently, too?
That's fairly recent, too, as well. We used to contract with the Ames Library.
Oh, yeah.
The bookmobile would come up here once a week. One year during council, that contract came up, and I thought we were paying about as much for the bookmobile to come one day a week as we were paying for the Story County deputies to come and take care of our town. And so I thought maybe we should look into Story City. So I went up to Story City and spoke with Colleen, their administrator, and asked, is there something that you could do? So to begin with, she brought up a couple of shelves of books that we had in our little city hall building, our old city hall building. So that was the first year. And then the city purchased this building and that building. And then we moved the library into there.
Well, I know from my involvement with the Bertha Bartlett Library that you have great circulation here.
We do.
So it's really been successful.
Very, very successful. My sister reads a lot, and she can get books faster here than she can in Ames, reserving them.
Sure.
You know, it takes longer for them to get back, and here they make trips all the time.
What's going on at the library? Do you have some activities for children, too?
We do. We have a wonderful summer program for the kids. And a lot of times they have early out programs on Wednesdays. They also work with preschool kids one day a week. They're very active with the children.
Is that a story time?
Yes. The library is fairly new. The front part of the building is the library and the back part is the Red Buckman Community Center.
And what do you use the community center for?
We have two groups of coffee guys. One group comes every day. They start about 4 o'clock in the morning, and they're usually out of there by 7 o'clock, 7:30. Then we have another group that comes just Monday through Friday, and they come about 8 o'clock and stay till about 9. And then we rent it out. A lot of children's parties, showers, baby showers. At Christmas time, we always have it rented for 2 or 3 days in a row. People having their family Christmases there. We have a celebration every summer called Gilbert Days, and we usually there will be a class or two that has their reunion during that time, and then I try to have this open so that they can come up here.
I saw your centennial booklet, and it looks like 1879 was the date.
Correct.
That they used for the founding.
And yes.
And
yes.
Apparently had a great celebration at that time. And so Gilbert dates from that time, which is late 19th century.
Correct.
And like every development, it was involved with proximity to the railroad.
When Gilbert was first started, it was Gilbert Station. Gilbert, Iowa was in Polk County. There also was a Gilbert, Iowa on the east side of Iowa. I'm assuming that was before the Polk County Gilbert. So when Gilbert was first incorporated, it was Gilbert Station. Then when Des Moines kind of took up their Gilbert, Iowa, it became Des Moines, then we dropped the word station. We are hoping to have a commercial district out on the east side of town.
Where the furniture consignment is?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, see, that's the area where you're not landlocked. That could develop.
Right.
Into more of a commercial.
And they're hoping, the owner of that land is hoping to build both residential and commercial out there, perhaps like Somerset area. We would like to have commercial in that area.
Yeah, right. But it's really just commercial, so that the people who live here could shop here.
Correct.
Gilbert is different from any other town we visited. Of course, each one is unique, and the school is the anchor for all the ones who have schools. But Gilbert schools almost overwhelm the town. Their tax base does enable them to have quite a new city hall. There's going to be a League of Women Voters legislative wake-up call there. And their volunteer fire station, also new, has a big community room. Both of these are on the east edge of town by the high school.
But it's still an old town and not a new suburb. It has a history and people who cherish it. Gilbert is certainly a healthy, growing town.
Our last guest today is Raleigh Link, who has just launched a whole series of detective novels. Oh, I guess he's launched one, and there are more to come. After suffering from writer's block for over a decade.
Well, hello, Raleigh. And from what I read in the Story City Herald, it sounds as if your story is as compelling as what you're writing about. So why don't you start with, well, your earliest ambitions to be a writer?
Well, I graduated from Iowa State University in 1981 with a degree in English. And I think most every student who graduates with a degree in English has a desire to one day write a book. And so I started thinking about writing a book back in the 80s.
And so it's been a long trail to this, too, because so often when you look at people in a reunion from college, you find out, well, now who's working in the area of their major? Now, you had a long trail to do the writing of the book, and tell us about your, well, you were a police officer for 29 years, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I was going to college on the GI Bill, and while I was going to college, I happened to see in the Ames newspaper that they were hiring police officers. I had been in the Navy and done some shore patrol, and I thought that might be a good way to make a little extra money temporarily until I got through with college. And so I graduated, but I just stayed there then for 29 years.
So your temporary job lasted 29 years, and you were a policeman here in Ames. And tell us about life as a cop, first of all, in Ames, Iowa. This isn't exactly the Naked City, but I'm sure that was interesting, Raleigh.
Yeah, it's an interesting job. I think one aspect of it that's the most interesting is the hours and the schedule. Most of my career I was on patrol, and I worked either 3 to 11 in the evening or 11 to 7 in the morning. I did spend some time on a special unit that walked the bars in Campus Town and downtown.
Oh, the bar beat, right?
The bar beat. Yeah, you've heard of the bar beat.
The bar beat.
Okay. Yeah, I worked that, and that was days on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, nights on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and then I had Sunday and Monday off. So the hours are just crazy when you're working on the police department.
You never know what to expect. It might be a domestic call. It could be a traffic accident. There could be a robbery or a burglary. And then I suppose you have to coordinate with the Iowa State campus police when Iowa State upsets Oklahoma out at Jack Trice Field and people go crazy, right?
Yeah, that's always a challenge.
So all this time in the police department led you not only to be a writer, but also you're writing about crime and detectives. Who are these? You have some characters. They're probably going to be the red thread that runs through all your books. And I think that these folks are called, well, who are they, these two detectives?
Well, these two, excuse me, these two detectives are Max Mosby and Skip Murray. And they were two police officers. They were doing the bar beat, and they buy lottery tickets every week. Powerball tickets, and they win the Powerball. They win $228 million. They kind of go apart a little bit, and then they come back together because they're bored, and they start this detective agency, G&B Detective Agency.
So this G&B Detective Agency is your springboard, the core pot line for everything that happens to these two guys. And then we have two other characters, Monica and Milton. Now, Monica is an ex-stripper, I believe, right? How do they come in contact with Monica? Is she also a character that runs through the novels?
Yes, she is. She was a stripper, and when in the first chapter of The Missing Tucker, you hear about Monica, and Monica was a stripper, and the guys were doing the bar beat, and she was at this bar that they went to every night to check on. And they got to know her quite well. She was she wanted to go back and get back into college, but she had she was a single mother with a daughter. And so when they started their detective agency, they decided that they would go see if Monica wanted to be their receptionist. And the big thing about the agency is that these guys just want somewhere to go to get away from the wives. They really don't want to take cases. They just sort of need an identity. And so they figured Monica was tough and worldly, and that nobody was going to get past her.
Now, are the wives threatened by Monica? Now, they're going down to the office where the receptionist is a real knockout, right?
Yeah. No, the wives aren't threatened by her at all.
And then explain who Milton is. He's a current police officer who is probably their lead-in to the current things happening at the police department, right?
That's correct. That's Milton's role in the books is to be their sort of connection to the police department. The history is that Milton was actually trained by Max. And so
well,
they...
His mentor was Max.
Yes.
And that's really almost an obligation for him to be cooperative and collaborative with Max, isn't it?
That's correct.
And they're tempting him to do things that might be right on the edge of what a police officer does.
Yeah, and Max does know what buttons to push and how far he can go with Milton.
So it's really an interesting dynamic. So the first book is the G&B Detective Agency, The Case of the Missing Tucker.
Yes.
And now I think everybody out there knows that, and they dream of writing the great American novel. And tell me about how you went about being published.
Well, it was interesting because I wrote this book, and a friend of mine, Neil Bowers, who was a professor here at Iowa State University and has published a lot of books, was sort of my mentor and helping me. So I was sending the book to a lot of literary agents trying to get it published. And I wasn't getting very far, and I sent it to probably a dozen literary agents or more, and I had one actually get back to me and say, you know, this is a new age, and if you really want to get noticed, you need to self-publish your book and get some people buying it, and then come back later and talk to me about it. So it seemed that was the new way of going to it, that the literary agents were looking at books that were already being published, already out there.
So this is a new world.
Yes.
To me, it's analogous to the music industry. You know, it used to be that everyone hoped for a record contract. Now it seems like you perform on YouTube or give yourself some kind of self-authored exposure. You're spotted by somebody or you get a lot of play on YouTube, and then that's how people in the industry see you. And so this is the same thing. You self-publish and then to see what kind of following you get. And then maybe a literary agent picks you up then and you get published on a bigger scale. Is that right?
Exactly. You nailed it. That's exactly what they're doing now. And so I went to CreateSpace, which is associated with Amazon. And I went through the process to publish the book myself through Amazon.
Now, what kind of standards are there to be met there? Are they going to take anybody with a book, or is there someone doing some editorial things there that say this is worthy or not worthy, or do you just make your own publishing event happen?
Well, there's a review process, but I believe that they'll pretty much publish anything that fits within their parameters and
through Amazon, your book was available then. Is that correct?
Yeah, my book is available through Amazon, and also there's a in a paperback and a Kindle version.
And so we're waiting to see what kind of response is going on. In the meantime, you've written the second book. What's the title of that one?
The second book is GMB Detective Agency Case of the Lonely Farmer.com.
CaseOfTheLonelyFarmer.com.
Correct.
Wow, it's intriguing. And just like Sherlock Holmes, the tagline for all these books is G&B Detective Agency, then the separate case.
Yes, these are cases that like their wives and their friends talk them into because, like I said, they don't want to take cases, but they get talked into them.
They back into all these cases and they're just sort of swept into it.
Yes.
This kind of reminds me of movie noir where this private eye is sitting in a smoky office and he's just wanting to sit there and relax for a while. And here comes a blonde with a big problem, right?
Yeah, but more like here comes a wife with a big problem or here comes a friend with a big problem.
And this is all happening in the fertile mind of Raleigh Link, right?
Yeah.
So you've come up with these characters and you've got these basic folks that are going to appear in all the books. You have your two detectives and Monica and Milton. They're going to appear in all the books.
Yes.
And the interplay with them is going to mesh with whatever new people come into the plot in each book. And so the first book is out now. It's called The Case of the Missing Tucker. And the second book has been written, right?
Yes. Actually, my editor has it right now.
And so, and then there's a third book in the offing, I understand. Is that right?
Yes. The third book is GMB Detective Agency, Where the Hell is Angie?
Where the Hell is Angie? Oh, well, you've already got my curiosity piqued. And I can tell you're a very productive writer. You've really taken off with this thing. So if this becomes a – I'd like to see you have a cult following where suddenly people on Park Avenue says, have you read Raleigh's latest book? Well, you simply must.
I'd love to have a cult following too.
You just have to be at the right party. I could just see a book signing at a place on Fifth Avenue when everyone is there. Who's anybody?
Yeah, that would be nice, wouldn't it?
Raleigh Link. And then eventually when you really make it is when your name precedes the title, you know? You know, a handful of authors are in that position where their name is there and then the title's way below them because everyone buys the label, you know. Raleigh Link, that could be the fashionable author of the future because the great authors usually are people who write about this very subject, you know, the legal system, police work, mysteries. And it's kind of – this might be the kind of beach – book you have. They call them beach books where it's a page turner and you sit under the umbrella and I can hardly wait to see what Monica's up to.
Well, I think years ago when I was younger and I was just got out of college, I was looking for to be an author, write books and get the fame and fortune. But at my age right now, I just want to write books and have people read them. The fame and fortune would be nice, but if people just got my book and read it, that would be nice.
Well, you never know. You know, dreams flourish, and sometimes things happen that we're really not expecting. But you never know who'll pick up the book and what kind of network might develop and what kind of following you might have because all kinds of big things started modestly. And my hope is that someday your name will precede the title on the book page, on the title page. And you certainly are not someone who has writer's block anymore, do you?
No, actually, when I started writing this book, I was going to write a different book, and this one came to me, and I wrote the first chapter, and the character started living in my head. And so they just keep – I really don't have as much control over them as they're just doing things, and I'm chronicling it. And as long as they're doing
– I hear all authors say that. These characters have a life of their own.
Yes.
And I can't control what they do, and they just develop, and I've got to write about it. It seems like the same mechanism is happening to Raleigh Link, right?
Yeah, it is. And I was just talking to my wife yesterday is that then I write the book, and then I have – and then I write it, and it's sort of a stream of consciousness thing, and then I rewrite it. And it's a neat thing because, you know, in life we're always saying, oh, I wish I could have gone back and done that over again.
Oh, yeah.
So I get to go back and rewrite the book the
second
time.
But what our audience needs to know is that your wife is your editor.
Correct.
And so this all happens in-house, and she makes sure you work every day, right?
Yes.
You write every day? And
No, she doesn't make me. I get up in the morning, and I'm ready to write something.
That's fantastic. Well, Raleigh Link, a Nevada High School graduate, Iowa State graduate, a 29-year policeman in Ames, Iowa, dealing with the mean streets of Ames, and now living his dream as an author, a mystery series he's going to be writing for it's the G&B Detective Agency, with these two hapless detectives who won the lottery and founded their own detective agency. And they are reluctant detectives, but they get drawn into all kinds of intrigue. So, Raleigh Link, thanks for being our guest today, and you're my favorite author so far today.
Well, great. Thank you.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Paul Wearson and I, Susan Franson, have been your hosts for today. Other voices you heard were Pat Schlarbaum,
Cal Halliburton, Deidre DeJure,
Amanda Doring, Terry Harmon Gallahan, and Raleigh Link.
Well, you can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org, where you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories.
Local Talk was engineered by Jackie Norman. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
And Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. And if you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878, 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Just look for the yellow donate button.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening and
see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes from ISU Theater, presenting Oklahoma, a musical love story of Cowboy Curly and Farm Girl Lori, April 5th through the 8th in Ames. Tickets and showtimes available at theater.iastate.edu.